You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Arapaho County News, read by Tim Elliott. This is being recorded on June 16, 2024. Today we will be reading the following main articles. 3 weeks only. Get 'em if you light 'em in Aurora for July 4th holiday, by Max Levy, Sentinel, Colorado staff writer. Report finds Colorado was built on $1.7 trillion of land expropriated from tribal nations, by the Associated Press. Activists criticize Inglewood School's comment policy, by Elizabeth Slay. Meet third-generation hat shaper Parker Thomas at the Mile High Hoedown, by Joanne M. Colton. Sheridan Man 55 Missing Since Sunday, by Isabel Guzman. Why Allergy Season Along Colorado's Front Range Might Be Worse This Year, by Nina Joss. And following up with miscellaneous articles. 3 weeks only. Get 'em if you light 'em in Aurora for July 4th holiday. Aurora firefighters announced Thursday that residents will be allowed to buy and use their own fireworks for the next 3 weeks, as the city's fire service and 911 dispatchers steel themselves for the July 4th holiday. The announcement was made first during an Aurora City Council Policy Committee meeting. Later the same day, Aurora Fire Rescue issued a news release asking the public to follow the law. Even as lawmakers acknowledge the phenomenon of residents launching illegal fireworks has grown, quote, out of control, end quote. This situation is like a dike with 100 holes in it, and we can put our fingers in 2 of them, Council Member Steve Sundberg said at the committee meeting. We get the most hateful, frustrated emails, phone calls, and text messages from residents. It's hard to describe the angst that these people have. Aurora's blanket ban on fireworks is reconsidered every year ahead of July 4th, per the city's fireworks ordinance. In the weeks preceding the holiday, firefighters review environmental data collected by University of Colorado researchers and weigh other climate information before deciding whether to lift the ban June 15th through July 4th. Commander Steve Wright of Aurora Fire Rescue told lawmakers that, for now, conditions justify suspending the ban, meaning residents will be allowed to buy and use sparklers, fountains, and other fireworks that remain on the ground and don't explode. City Manager Jason Batchelor described the city walking a fine line between stifling celebrations and enabling mayhem in its regulatory tug-of-war with firework fans. If you're coming down too hard, folks are like, what's the matter? This is part of the holiday. On the other hand, you've got folks that take it too far. We've got folks that are going to Wyoming and getting military-grade mortars, he said. In its June 13th release, Aurora Fire Rescue described how a man was killed earlier this year by illegal fireworks detonated in Aurora Park, and a townhome complex scorched last year by legal fireworks thrown in a trash can. Citing statistics from the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission and the National Fire Protection Association, the release describes how tens of thousands of fires and emergency room visits are caused each year by fireworks. None of the nationally recognized metrics we monitor to assess environmental fire risk in our community exceed these thresholds requiring a fire ban. Fire Chief Alec Otten said in the release, we urge those in our community to take precautions to prevent injuries or fires if you choose to celebrate Independence Day with fireworks. Violating the city's fireworks ordinance is punishable by a fine of up to $2,650 and up to a year of imprisonment in addition to other fees and costs that may be imposed by the Aurora Municipal Court. Children younger than 16 aren't allowed to possess or use fireworks unless supervised by an adult over the age of 21. During Thursday's policy committee meeting, city and fire officials talked about how the city is preparing for the holiday and letting residents know what to expect in terms of how fireworks laws will be enforced. Aurora Fire Rescue plans to staff up its wildland firefighting crews during the week of July 4th to increase its response capacity and proactively patrol the city. While Wright said firefighters are allowed to confiscate illegal fireworks, cut tickets, and investigate complaints, they can't make arrests or otherwise do the job of sworn police officers. The agency will also share safety information at upcoming town halls and other community events, and plans to leave informational handouts at fireworks tents during inspections. A unified command center run by Aurora Fire Rescue, Aurora's Office of Emergency Management, and the Aurora Police Department will coordinate emergency responses on the day of the holiday. As for reports of illegal fireworks, except in the case of emergencies, the city will direct residents to call 303-627-5678, which will accept non-emergency calls starting 6 a.m. July 1st. Residents can also report illegal fireworks online at www.auroragov.org/contact us. Report finds Colorado was built on $1.7 trillion of land expropriated from tribal nations. A report published this week by a Native American-led nonprofit examines in detail the dispossession of $1.7 trillion worth of indigenous homelands in Colorado by the state and the U.S., and the more than $546 million the state has reaped in mineral extraction from them. The report, shared first with the Associated Press, identifies 10 tribal nations that have, quote, Aboriginal title, congressional title, and treaty title to lands within Colorado, end quote, and details the ways the land was legally and illegally taken. It determined that many of the transactions were in direct violation of treaty rights or in some cases lacked title for a legal transfer. Once we were removed, they just simply started divvying up the land, creating parcels and selling it to non-natives and other interests and businesses, said Dallin Mayberry, an artist, legal scholar, and enrolled member of the Northern Arapaho tribe who took part in the Truth, Restoration, and Education Commission, which compiled the report. When you think about examples of land theft, Mayberry continued, that is one of the most blatant instances that we could see. The commission was convened by People of the Sacred Land, a Colorado-based nonprofit that works to document the history of indigenous displacement in the state. The commission and its report are modeled after similar truth and reconciliation commissions that sought to comprehensively account for genocide and the people still affected by those acts and governmental policies. The report also recommends actions that can be taken by the state, the federal government, and Congress, including honoring treaty rights by resolving illegal land transfers, compensating the tribal nations affected, restoring hunting and fishing rights, and levying a 0.1% fee on real estate deals in Colorado to, quote, mitigate the lasting effects of forced displacement, genocide, and other historical injustices, end quote. If acknowledgement is the first step, then what is the second step, Mayberry said. That's where some of the treaties come in. They guaranteed us health and welfare and education, and we just simply want them to live up to those promises. That could look something like what happened not long ago in Canada, where following the conclusion of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in 2015, the government set aside $4.7 billion to support indigenous communities affected by its Indian residential schools. The U.S. currently has no similar commission, but a bill co-sponsored by Rep. Tom Cole, Representative Oklahoma, a Chickasaw Nation citizen, and Rep. Sharice Davids, Democrat, Kansas, a citizen of the Ho Chink Nation, would establish a commission to research and document the long-term effects of the Indian boarding school system in the U.S. That measure passed the House Education and Workforce Committee on Thursday with bipartisan support. The United States carried out a federal policy of genocide and extermination against Native peoples, and their weapon against our youngest and most vulnerable was the policy of Indian boarding schools, said Ben Barnes, chief of the Shawnee tribe, who testified before Congress in support of a commission to investigate the ongoing effects of the boarding schools. The next step is reconciliation and healing for the generations who've dealt with the trauma that followed, which begins with establishing the Truth and Healing Commission to investigate further, Barnes said. The 771-page report also calls on Colorado State University to return 19,000 acres of land that was taken from several tribal nations through the Morrell Act, signed by Abraham Lincoln in 1862, which used expropriated land to create land-grant universities across the country. In 2023, the university pledged to commit $500,000 of the earnings from its land-grant holdings. But while the commission commended that decision, it said, quote, there are questions about its adequacy given the resources that have been generated by the endowment created by selling and or leasing stolen land, end quote. A university spokesperson told AP that the school has not had a chance to review the report, but noted that, quote, that revenue from the Endowment Land Income Fund is used for the benefit of Native American faculty, staff, and students, end quote. The commission also found that Native American students in Colorado have lower high school graduation rates and higher dropout rates than any other racial demographic. It determined that state schools teach about Native American issues only once in elementary school and then again in high school U.S. history classes. And it called on the Colorado Department of Education to increase the amount of its curriculum that focuses on the histories, languages, and modern cultures of tribal nations that are indigenous to the state. The Education Department said in a statement that it is, quote, committed to elevating and honoring our indigenous communities, end quote. We have worked alongside tribal representatives to create a culturally affirming fourth grade curriculum focused on Ute history fourth grade curriculum and have made this available to our school districts and educators, the statement added. However, that educational program is not mandatory across Colorado, where curriculum decisions are made at the local level. A 2019 study found that 87% of public schools in the U.S. fail to teach about indigenous peoples in a post-1900 context, and that most states make no mention of them in their K-12 curriculum. They should be an integral part of the curriculum, especially in areas where there is a high percentage of Native Americans, said Richard Littlepear, former president of Chief Dull Knife College in Montana and a member of the Northern Cheyenne tribe. There's got to be a full-scale effort. Cherry Creek readies 6% pay hikes for teachers, more for some district office workers. By Krista No. Beginning next month, all Cherry Creek School District employees are slated to get at least a 6% salary hike, pushing teacher salaries to the top in the region. Some employee groups will get even larger raises, some as high as 17%. During a Board of Education meeting Tuesday, Scott Smith, Chief Financial Officer for the school district, presented a brief report on the district's budget for the upcoming school year. This included employee raises and enrollment changes. Smith said different employee groups are analyzed, and their salaries are compared and adjusted to the market in the three-year cycles. This year, the district analyzed the salaries of people working in the following departments: construction, maintenance, ground and carpentry, CMGC, office staff, EOP, food and nutrition services, FNS, and administrators. Teacher salaries were analyzed last year, according to Smith's presentation. Teachers' base annual salary will rise to $61,058. Following the district's analysis, employees in the CMGC group will receive an 11% raise, EOP a 17% raise, FNS an 11% raise, and administrators will receive a 7% raise. Those numbers include cost of living increases for the year. Not all employees could be eligible for the pay hikes if their positions weren't deemed, quote, below market, end quote. The new salary tops starting teacher pay in surrounding districts. In the neighboring Aurora Public Schools, the proposed starting salary for teachers during the 2024-25 school year is about $59,000. For Douglas County School District, it is $51,400. I think that's a strong statement that we value our educators and make sure that we can reward them with compensation increases in this high inflationary environment, Smith said. The raises for district employees will go into effect beginning July 1st, according to district spokesperson Abby Smith. Smith said that the school district was also able to, quote, invest $2 million in employee medical benefits, end quote, in an effort to reduce employee premiums. We want to make sure that we put as much money into our students and the people who work directly with our students as possible, Smith said. Also discussed at the budget presentation was the ongoing declining enrollment in schools, which Scott Smith said is 5% less than what was reported before the pandemic in 2019. He added that the state's retiree population is increasing, which will inevitably change the economy. Scott Smith also spoke about how the state is financially supporting public education. He spoke about the recent school finance bill, which, quote, brings us back to 1989 levels of funding adjusted for inflation, end quote. He also mentioned that the state continues to underfund the universal preschool program, and the school district has to supplement that from the general fund. Aurora woman pleads guilty to murdering daughter 5, burning body in fireplace, by the Sentinel. An Aurora woman convicted of murdering her 5-year-old daughter and burning her body in the fireplace was sentenced Wednesday to 84 years in prison. While there is no way to fully comprehend what turned this mother into a monster, she deserves to spend several decades behind bars for the unspeakable crime she committed, said District Attorney John Kellner. Alexis Nelson, 28, pleaded guilty to second-degree murder, tampering with a deceased body and attempting to influence a public servant. The 84-year-old sentence was part of a plea deal. Nelson was arrested a year ago in connection with her missing daughter, Maha Lee Hobbs, 5. On May 29, 2013, Aurora 911 dispatchers received a call from Nelson's mother, who said her daughter had made concerning statements recently by text. The caller also raised concerns about the safety of their granddaughter, the release said. Officers visited Nelson at her apartment in the 1,000 block of South Elkhard Way, where according to the release she told them she had given her daughter up for adoption but did not provide any documentation. Nelson told police she had given up her daughter in a legal adoption about a month earlier and did not want her mother to know where she was, according to an arrest affidavit. She said she had worked with the agency Adoptions with Love but did not provide any records, and the agency director told police that she had not had any contact with Nelson. The Internet Crimes Against Children Unit then contacted Nelson. According to the affidavit, Nelson told detectives that she did not feel like she had the resources to provide for her daughter, which is why she had placed her for adoption. After being told that Adoptions of Love had no record of her, Nelson allowed police to search her phone for emails, the affidavit said. Detectives could not find any evidence of a transaction. The girl's father lives out of state and told police that he had not seen his daughter in about 2 years, the affidavit said. Police interviewed a maintenance worker in the complex who had entered the apartment and noticed that the second bedroom was locked and a piece of rope was connected from the door to the door of the bathroom across the hall. It appears that someone was trying to keep someone else locked in the bedroom door, the affidavit said. He noticed children's toys in the apartment but did not hear anyone inside the bedroom. Police obtained a search warrant for Nelson's apartment, 18th Judicial District official said in a statement after the conviction Wednesday. Upon opening a utility closet door on the apartment's patio, a detective recognized the odor of decomposing flesh. Inside a bag, detectives found the charred human remains of Nelson's daughter. Bone fragments and ashes were also located inside Nelson's fireplace. Prosecutors did not release details about how the girl was killed. While we were fully prepared to take this case to trial, this plea protects Maha Lee's family from having to listen to painful, horrific, and gruesome testimony, Chief Deputy D.A. Chris Gallo said in a statement. Detectives with the Aurora Police Department were able to quickly punch holes in the defendant's story, which ultimately helped us quickly solve this case and bring justice to Maha Lee's family. Decades after, South Korea honors Colorado war vets at Aurora Ceremony. By Krista No, Sentinel, Colorado. More than a dozen Korean War veterans and their family members were honored with the Ambassador for Peace Medal during a ceremony at City Hall Wednesday morning. The medal, quote, is an expression of appreciation from the Korean government to American veterans who served in the Korean War, end quote, according to a press statement from the city. The medal was presented to the veterans by Yong Tak Lim, Consul General of the Republic of Korea. Aurora Mayor Mike Kaufman and Colorado Lieutenant Governor Diana Primavera also stood alongside Lim and thanked the veterans for their service. Quote, about 74 years ago, young soldiers from diverse backgrounds bravely answered the call to support democracy and freedom of South Korea against communist aggression. Their bravery and sacrifice created the foundation for the Republic of Korea to emerge from the devastation, Lim said. The veterans awarded with a medal are Freddie Dwayne Brewer, Edward Sylvester Britton Jr., Gerald Robert Baudry, Richard Charles Hall, Leon Eugene Henry, Robert J. Ree, Edward T. Rodriguez, Joseph John Sheeb, Wayne K. Toby, Gary F. Wilson, Jesse Frank Wilson, Richard Gene Eccles, deceased, William Gustav Erickson, deceased, Glenn William Timon, deceased, Charles Douglas Ward, deceased, Bobby Alfred Goodwin, missing in action, presumed dead, Rufino Simbri, killed in action. Not all veterans attended the ceremony in person. Family members received the medal in place of the veterans who could not attend in person. The surviving family members of deceased veterans received the medal on behalf of the veteran. Aurora lawmakers stalled proposal to move domestic violence cases out of city courts. By Max Levy, Sentinel, Colorado staff writer. A proposal to hand all misdemeanor domestic violence cases off to county courts earned a mixed reception at its first Aurora City Council hearing Monday, as some city lawmakers questioned the impact that the shift could have on crime victims. The item, sponsored by Dustin Zavonik and supported by Danielle Jurinski, both influential conservatives who have authored much of the majority's public safety policy, was endorsed by a council policy committee last month. However, on Monday, other conservatives and council members questioned the decision to move the prosecutions out of the Aurora Municipal Court over objections from overlapping counties that they don't have the resources needed to pick up Aurora's caseload. Arapahoe County in particular has warned that without additional funding, such a change could result in justice for victims being delayed. According to an estimate by the county, close to 1,600 cases would be moved into its jurisdiction annually as a result of the change, costing upward of $2.45 million. When we send these hundreds of cases to the counties, they're not going to get the attention they deserve, Councilmember Curtis Gardner said. I don't understand why something this drastic, why we have to rush into it. Aurora is one of just a handful of Colorado cities that handle domestic violence cases in their municipal courts rather than forward them to county courts. The city council decided to move those prosecutions in-house in the 1980s, citing concerns about other jurisdictions not making them a priority. Pete Schult of the Aurora City Attorney's Office said in a response to a question from council member Allison Combs that handing cases off to the counties would likely result in some cases not being prosecuted, quote, as vigorously, end quote. Zavonik has argued that by volunteering to prosecute domestic violence, Aurora is, quote, subsidizing, end quote, counties and unnecessarily taking on a cost that other cities avoid. He pointed out June 10th that district attorneys are already expected to handle more complex and serious cases of domestic violence that arise in the city. It wouldn't be a new process for them, he said. We clearly put a lot of trust in our judicial districts to prosecute domestic violence cases and ones where they reach a felony level. I have enough confidence in our DA's office that they will prosecute these on behalf of the victims. The proposal also comes after Colorado's General Assembly passed and Governor Jared Polis signed a bill that would prohibit cities that prosecute domestic violence from providing public defender services on the basis of flat fee contracts. Zavonik previously argued that the city should move away from handling domestic violence in case it ultimately decides to privatize the work of the Aurora Public Defender Office. The city received no response earlier this year when it asked private law firms to bid on replacing the office. The version of the proposal that Zavonik brought Monday did not specify when it would go into effect. City council members told council members that outstanding warrants in pending cases could mean the city continuing to move cases through its court for at least a few years after the effective date. Council member Angela Lawson also said she was concerned about the impact Zavonik's proposal could have on victims of violence, bringing up how prosecuting cases locally spares victims and witnesses trips to county courthouses in Brighton and Centennial for hearings and to obtain protection orders. That can mean life or death for a victim, Lawson said. Zavonik said he believed the distance victims must travel to attend district court hearings currently was a failure of those jurisdictions rather than the city. He ultimately agreed to postpone the proposal to a future meeting, saying he agreed the transition process will need to be thought through if the council decided to move forward. It would impact a lot of people in our community, Zavonik said. There would be a transition phase. I would obviously be willing and open to feedback on that transition date to make this move effective for us and be respectful of the counties who would have to absorb a large caseload. Activists criticize Englewood School's comment policy. Anderson, Holmes sit with mouths taped shut at meeting. In protest to recent changes that Englewood Board of Education made to its public comment policy, Owen Ty Anderson wore duct tape on his mouth and silently listened during the board's June 4th meeting. It's very evident the Board of Education changed the public comment policy in retaliation to community members from black organizations that spoke out against the treatment of black students, educators, and school board members included, Anderson, former Denver Board of Education, told the Englewood Herald after the meeting. In recent months, the district has pushed back against Anderson's claims that it is falling short in equity and inclusion efforts. Anderson, the CEO of the Center for Advanced Black Excellence in Education, was joined by Midian Holmes, Education, an Epitome of Black Excellence and Partnership CEO in the Center for Protest. She also wore duct tape on her mouth. The protest comes after Inglewood school board members made a unanimous vote in May to change the board's public comment policy to allow only those with connections to the district to speak during public comment sessions at meetings. Anderson and Holmes spoke at that meeting just before the change was made, raising concern about the treatment of black students, employees, and board members in the district. The following persons are eligible to address the board at a public meeting: residents of the district or property owners of the district, parents or guardians of students currently enrolled in the district, current and former students of the district, current district staff members, and individuals invited by the board president or superintendent to address the board on a designated topic, the new policy reads. Attorney Steve Zansberg, president of the Colorado Freedom of Information Coalition, said Colorado open meetings law has no requirement for public comment at meetings of school boards. Only that the public be allowed to attend and observe, Zansberg said. So, this issue comes down to strictly a matter of school district policy. Jeff Roberts, executive director of the Colorado Freedom of Information Coalition, said the law is silent on public comment policy, but offered a different point regarding certain policy enforcements. Once a school board or another type of public body decides to offer public comment, they cannot treat speakers in a discriminatory or viewpoint-restricted way, Roberts said. That's what the case law around the nation says, although there isn't a specific Colorado ruling. He added that school boards can make, quote, reasonable rules such as limiting the time per speaker and removing a speaker who causes a disturbance, end quote. Additionally, he said that it is questionable whether a non-resident could successfully challenge the board's new policy. Anderson and Holmes said they plan to continue to come to Inglewood school board meetings until its policy is reversed. Anderson was elected to the Denver Public Schools Board in 2019 and served until 2023. His board colleagues voted to censure him in 2021 after an investigation into allegations of misconduct found that he engaged in flirtatious messaging with DPS students and allegedly intimidated witnesses in that investigation through social media. Anderson and Holmes initially addressed the Inglewood board during April and May meetings, objecting to a travel reimbursement denial for school board member Devon Williams in March. They also presented their evaluation of the Inglewood board's diversity and inclusion efforts for the black community, an initiative they call the Green Book Initiative. In early May, they presented the board with an, quote, exodus rating, end quote, the lowest on their rubric, stating that they've been in contact with over 80 black families in and around the district, encouraging them not to enroll or re-enroll unless the board improves. During the meeting, Superintendent Joanna Polson referenced a news release sent out Tuesday by Anderson and Holmes just prior to the June 4th meeting. It announced that Anderson and Holmes' organizations retained, quote, former Denver District Attorney candidate Lizzy Owen to provide legal advisement and to take decisive legal action in support of the Green Book Initiative and other complementary strategies, end quote. The district was not aware of the press release that was issued June 4th by two individuals until we were forwarded the information from a news outlet regarding the press conference out front, Polson said. The district has not received any notice of a lawsuit filed by these individuals or their companies, and we cannot comment on threatened or pending litigation. That press release states, quote, "The Green Book Initiative is an empowering tool for black families and communities with essential insights into the safety and inclusivity of schools and governance teams. This initiative meticulously evaluates school districts to ensure that black students are placed in environments that not only recognize and celebrate their identity, but also actively support and help curate their growth and development," end quote. The initiative received criticism from several people, including Inglewood School's Director of Opportunity, Access, and Inclusion, Rana Razak. Razak said during a May meeting that, in correspondence, she saw between the district and the Green Book Initiative, there weren't any, quote, "methodologies, theories, or research-based frameworks," end quote, used to create the resource, so she couldn't speak to those elements directly. I think, to me, the most glaring thing is there was no mention or student voice or student experience or empowerment in that rubric, which isn't only one of my guiding tenets, but it's also a research-based indicator of equity and belonging in educational environments, Razak said. Additionally, Razak said while the rubric, which is divided into 8 categories rated on a 1-5 scale, is, quote, "beautiful and aspirational," end quote, there doesn't seem to be evidence to suggest the evaluation is, quote, "constructive and actionable, like an actual rubric or an equity audit might be," end quote. Meet third-generation hat shaper Parker Thomas at the Mile High Hoedown. Colorado-born Parker Thomas Orms always envisioned himself growing up and tackling life head-on as an athlete on a sports field. So, how did he wind up being a hat shaper and owner of Hats by Parker Thomas? The answer is fate. Parker's father, Glenn, has been a hat shaper all his life following the tradition set by his own father. Parker's grandpa, Dewey, started shaping hats 65 years ago in Texas and did so until his death in 2022. Parker inherited his passion for playing sports from his mom and her family. His mother, Catherine, lettered in softball at Northern Colorado in the 1970s. Parker Thomas Orms attended Colorado University Boulder 2010 to 2013 on a football scholarship and played defensive back for the Colorado Buffaloes football team. He was an engaging presence on the field and a fan favorite. Parker was on the path to joining the NFL, although football-related injuries, shoulder and hamstring injuries, and a torn ACL, for which he had to undergo surgery, likely ended that pursuit. In 2015, Parker traveled to Milan to play semi-pro football as a free safety punt return man for the Milano Rhinos, Italy's professional league. But after playing his last football season in Europe, Parker Thomas came home to his family and the family traditions that are tightly woven into the fabric of his being. So, it wasn't just a, quote, "hat," end quote, trick that led him to become a hat shaper, and Parker's success to proving to be far more rewarding than he could ever have imagined. I worked with my father and grandfather for 8 years, traveling around different rodeos and Western-themed events. I shaped and designed cowboy and fedora hats, said Parker, who has been adding his own sense of style and creativity to traditional hats while shaping his own destiny in the process. Then he opened Hats by Parker Thomas, https://www.hatsbyparkerthomas.com/, 2 years ago at 257 Fillmore Street, Unit 110, in the Cherry Creek area of Denver, where he met with his clientele by appointment. Parker and his small team of hat craftsmen also shape and sell his hats nationwide at private home parties with 5 to 25 people, weddings, corporate gatherings, and community events. Likewise, sports figures and celebrities like Reba McEntire are now a part of his overall customer base. Most of Parker's bookings are made through his business location or through Instagram and TikTok. The store and private events keep Parker busy these days, but he still enjoys opportunities to be part of community events like the June 29th Mile High Hoedown at the Stampede in Aurora. "I am really looking forward to meeting people at the Mile High Hoedown," said Parker, who explained that he welcomes every opportunity to support Colorado's lifestyle and interact with athletes, artists, and all others within its many communities. "Each hat and design depends on the needs of the customer and the customizations they choose," said Parker. He stated that although he can shape any type hat, he especially enjoys creating cowboy-style hats, which are so very popular throughout Colorado. "Most hats can be done in around 30 minutes, and I will make your hat to order right there at the Mile High Hoedown," said Parker, who mentioned that his custom wool or beaver blend hats range from $200 to $450. For additional fees, he also offers cleaning, reshaping, and branding services. Music lovers won't want to miss a beat when Boulder's very own Sun Jr. brings their, quote, "psych mountain rock," end quote, sounds to the stage. Dancers will love learning the latest line dances taught throughout the day by dance instructor choreographer Lori Burkhart. Attendees can visit vendor booths and print their own shirt or tank top with ink and drink, obtain a flash tattoo from Ace of Mr. Ace Art and Tattoos, and get interactive with some, quote, "not permanent but cool," end quote, body art, face painting, and or hair sparkle accents from Little People Face Painting. Enjoy food truck food, beverages, and stop by and meet with hat shaper Parker Thomas to purchase your custom hat. Get the, quote, "lowdown," end quote, on the Hoedown. Tickets and more at coloradocommunitymedia.com. Mark your calendars for CCM's Mile High Hoedown on Saturday, June 29th, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Stampede, 2431 South Havana Street in Aurora. Socialize with friends and or family, eat, drink, kick up your heels, and just have a rip-roaring good time. Tickets are $20 per ticket, $25 at the door, and includes the entry fee only. For a limited time, CCM is running a BOGO promotion on its website. Don't miss out. Buy your tickets today. Castle Rock, Douglas County opt out of new Colorado gun law, by McKenna Harford. Castle Rock's town council has decided to opt out of a new law that bans guns in government buildings and courthouses. The recent decision comes in the wake of 2024 law legislators passed that ban guns from sensitive spaces, including government buildings, starting July 1st. The law allows municipalities to opt out of the ban, and Castle Rock's council members unanimously approved an ordinance to do just that. The move maintains the town's policy that allows people to carry guns in the town hall. Castle Rock's town charter prevents the council from placing any restriction or limitation on the right of citizens to keep and bear firearms without voter approval, with the exception of laws regarding brandishing and discharging. Under Colorado law, open carrying of firearms is legal for people older than 18 and who can legally possess a firearm, and concealed carry is legal with a permit. "We certainly allow firearms to be carried in this, quote, sensitive space," end quote, town attorney Mike Hyman said. "We're really just preserving status quo." The ordinance was adopted on the first reading, so it's effective before the July 1st deadline. Typically, ordinances need two readings to pass. Douglas County Commissioners approved a similar ordinance opting out of the ban for county buildings in the unincorporated areas of the county. Hyman said he reached out to the county to work on opting out county buildings within Castle Rock boundaries through an amendment to the town's ordinance. Council member Laura Cavey said she supported the measure, as a move to protect gun rights and called for the state legislature to stop infringing on the Second Amendment. I really appreciate us doing this because our Second Amendment rights should not be infringed upon, Cavey said. Councilmember Max Brooks agreed and said that he's frustrated with the legislative efforts to usurp local control and pass state mandates. I am in favor of this simply from a matter of this being to retain a decision that has already been made at the ballot box by the voters of Castle Rock, Brooks said. I'm deaf to the legislation that comes out on the Second Amendment or any further erosion of local control from the state legislature. Brooks, a Republican, is running to represent Castle Rock at the state capitol in House District 45. He faces a primary against Republican Bill Jack on June 25th. Sheridan man, 55, missing since Sunday. Investigators in Sheridan are asking for help locating Gerard Grulet, a 55-year-old man who has been missing since Sunday. Grulet's family last saw him around 11:30 a.m. on June 9th near his home in the 3700 block of South Green Court in Sheridan. He went for a walk and has not been seen since. Grulet has white and brown hair, is 5'10" and 170 pounds. He was last seen wearing a white shirt, blue jeans, and black shoes. Foul play is not suspected. Those who may have any information about Grulet's whereabouts are asked to call the Sheridan Police Department, 303-762-2211. Why allergy season along Colorado's Front Range might be worse this year. As the flowers bloom, some people suffer. It's a prime time for seasonal allergies, and some may be feeling worse or suffering longer than in past years. The extra itchy eyes, wheezing, and sneezing could be related to climate change, which experts say is happening in Colorado. Plants bloom earlier, bloom later. Different species are moving in. Dr. Ming Wu, a family medicine doctor at Advent Littleton, said, "With all of this change, we're encountering things that our bodies have never encountered before." Allergies are overreactions to environmental stimuli, Wu said. Allergic reactions happen when the body perceives something not normally harmful as dangerous. To combat what the body perceives as a threat, the immune system fights against the stimulus, for instance pollen, triggering allergy symptoms. Climate change has brought concern to Colorado, which is expected in the years ahead to trend warmer, including earlier snow melt in the spring, hotter summers, and drier soils. Such a shift has the power, over time, to bring more of certain kinds of plants, while other kinds struggle, according to state scientists. Environmental changes can impact pollen seasons. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, climate change can cause shifts in precipitation, fewer frost days, warmer air temperatures, and increased atmospheric carbon dioxide. These changes can affect the length of the pollen season, how much pollen plants create, how much is in the air, and how likely the pollen is to cause irritation, according to the CDC. This year in Colorado, Wu said, the weather may play a role in people's experiences. Environmental allergies could potentially be worse because we've had a lot more rainfall. It's been a lot wetter, he said. Mold, pollen, those are going to be higher in the environment, and that can cause issues. He said it can be challenging for some people to know whether symptoms are related to allergies or a viral illness, since they often have similar symptoms. Both seasonal allergies and viral illnesses can involve a runny nose, sneezing, difficulty breathing, ear pain, and skin rashes, he said. To tell the difference, he said to look out for a few specific symptoms. The biggest things that I've noticed with allergies that don't really follow with a viral illness are itchy, watery eyes, and viral illnesses usually will present with fever whereas allergies don't present with a fever, he said. For people struggling with their seasonal allergies this year, Wu recommends over-the-counter antihistamines. For people who need extra help, doctors can prescribe stronger allergy medications, steroids, or immunotherapy, a process that slowly exposes a person to allergens to build tolerance. Immunotherapy is useful for environmental allergies, insect allergies, and asthma, he said. This should be done, obviously, with medical supervision. For pollen allergies, Wu said some people find that eating local honey can be a natural remedy. This is not a proven solution, he said, but some believe it helps slowly build immunity to the pollen in their area. How to stay safe in the water this summer, as told by Centennial Swim School, by Ellis Arnold. Drowning is the leading cause of death for children aged 1 to 4 years old, and for children aged 5 to 14, it's the second leading cause of unintentional injury death after motor vehicle crashes. That's according to the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which says formal swimming lessons can reduce the risk of drowning. In the Centennial area, one business owner stresses the importance of swim lessons. I wasn't a bad swimmer throughout my years, but I wasn't great by any means, and I never really felt safe in the water, said Wendy Skalrod, who lives in Centennial. And that's really one of the reasons my husband and I were led to purchase and bring Big Blue to our community, because feeling that lack of confidence as adults, and especially as a parent, not feeling safe or confident in the water is a really awful thing. They wanted to enable kids to feel sure of themselves, quote, so they never feel the same fears I did as an adult, end quote, said Skalrod, who owns the Big Blue Swim School location near Smoky Hill Road and Himalaya Street. Her location opened in May 2021, and she's come a long way from feeling uncertain in the water. She's now a certified lifeguard, and she offered some tips that can help you stay safe this summer. Staying alert. Safety is crucial wherever people swim, whether it's a backyard pool, a beach on a family vacation, a lake, or a neighborhood pool, Skalrod said. She shared the, quote, SAFER, quote, acronym that Big Blue uses to help people remember ways to avoid danger. Swim with a buddy and get a, quote, water watcher, end quote, an adult to keep an eye on you. Rotating people out doesn't hurt, so they're fresh and they're not getting vision fatigued, Skalrod said. Acquire CPR and first aid training. We encourage all of our parents, nannies, caregivers, older siblings to get training, she said. We have someone certified on staff who can give CPR and first aid training. They also can give lifeguard training. Find and reduce water hazards. Put fences around pools at home. And don't leave toys or items out that would entice a small child to go near a pool, Skalrod said. Ensure proper fitting life jackets are available for any water activities. Enroll in swim lessons to improve skills. Respond fast and call 911 in emergencies. A drowning incident isn't always obvious, Skalrod said, adding, never hesitate. Don't forget. Always be diligent around water, even in laid-back situations, Skalrod said. People get really comfortable, especially if they're in social environments and eating and drinking and enjoying the sun, she said. But, quote, always make sure you're aware of your surroundings and the people around you, end quote. Even good swimmers can be at risk of water accidents, she added. We just don't want to take for granted what kids know and what they don't know, Skalrod said. About the school. Her swimming school location teaches kids at different ages, including a baby level that focuses on breath control and back floating, and a level for toddlers between 3 and 5 that focuses on skills like balance. At that age, it's important that they enjoy coming to class, so we do use some games, some songs, and some stories that help them get excited, Skalrod said. For kids 6 and up, the lessons progress to shape, quote, proficient and strong swimmers, end quote, she said. Her swim school is large, so families can schedule multiple age groups at the same time, quote, which is really convenient for parents, end quote, she said. We also do water safety presentations in school, said Skalyarad, adding that that includes speaking at public and other types of schools. Quote, and we love it, end quote. Thank you for joining us for the Arapaho County News. My name is Tim Elliott.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.